Welcome back to Class X, Updates in Education Law. I'm Lisa.
I'm Miriam.
And we're attorneys at Walter Haverfield in Cleveland, Ohio. We practice school law, and every few weeks we get together and talk about the most recent legal developments in education relevant to school boards, administrators, teachers, really anyone who works in education.
And today we are taking a look at how coronavirus concerns are affecting school districts in Ohio and around the country. We are recording remotely today. Each of us is in a separate location, and we're joined by phones. We are also joined by Christina Peer, who is an attorney at Walter Haverfield, and she frequently advises school districts on their obligations relating to students. And that's what we'll be talking about today, how school districts' obligations to students are changing in light of this.
Thank you so much, Miriam. It's good to be here with you, even remotely by phone. We'll do our best to bring this all together and get some information out there that I think people are going to find helpful given the current situation.
I'm sure you've been inundated with COVID-19 questions, and we much appreciate your joining us today.
Absolutely. Yes, thank you for joining us, Christina. So before we get started, I do want to emphasize that this topic, even more than our usual topics that we always say are ever evolving, this is rapidly developing almost daily, if not hourly. So it is important to be in touch with your state and local boards of health, of course, as well as district council and your boards of education. We will be talking about general questions that we've been fielding and some ways to approach these issues. But if you have specific immediate concerns, your best bet is really going to be to turn to your district attorneys, who are going to know the details of your particular circumstances and what is going on in your particular state. Most of our conversations here are going to relate to the current developments in Ohio and Ohio counties, which have now begun a minimal of at least 3-week closure that was ordered by Ohio's Governor DeWine. So your state and local governments may have additional regulations, requirements that you should consult. But let's dive back just into a little bit of background, Miriam.
Sure. So just a little background about coronavirus. You know, I'm sure most of our audience knows this already, that the COVID-19, as it is officially termed, began with an outbreak in Wuhan, China, but it's quickly spread to more than 100 countries around the world, including, of course, the United States. This virus is particularly concerning because it's new, and it also has a higher mortality rate than other viruses previously have had, especially with older populations and those with compromised immune systems. Recently, the World Health Organization declared a pandemic related to the COVID-19 virus, and we have had a national emergency declared so as to allow funding to be freed up and to allow for greater flexibility in decision-making. In general, the idea right now is to slow the spread of infection. That's considered a high priority, and the goal of that is to ensure that healthcare facilities will be able to keep up so that those people who need medical resources like respirators or hospital beds will have access to them. And of course, school districts, I know, Lisa, you mentioned that you just had a closure with school districts in Ohio for 3 weeks, and that's part of slowing this epidemic. Lisa, can you talk a little bit more about what school districts are doing?
Yeah, and the closure may be somewhat of a misstatement as we're talking about kind of the physical buildings, but districts across the state and country certainly are still looking at how to still educate children. But as part of this effort, some districts have been canceling extracurricular activities, athletic events, certainly not bringing together large crowds of people. Many schools, including universities as well as our K-12 districts, are switching to online instruction and have otherwise canceled in-person classes. We also have districts making decisions about other events, consulting with state, local boards of health, but also nationally. There seems to be a trend to be closing school districts for at least 3 weeks, which is what we just begun in the state of Ohio. And again, that's being referenced as at least 3 weeks. We're not sure how that's going to develop past that time frame and are looking at what education will look like for our students in these districts moving forward. And certainly we've seen a good majority of states at this point over the last week move towards closing schools, at least for the time being. So, Miriam, do you want to try to start with some of the key questions we've been fielding lately?
Yeah, sure. So I'm sure, Christina, you've had a ton of questions relating to students and parents. even before the schools were closed. Yes.
That's right. And I think, you know, it's important to note for some of your listeners, they are in areas where schools remain open. Here in Ohio, as I believe Lisa said earlier, schools are closed at least for the next 3 weeks, and there's no, you know, clarity yet in terms of when schools are going to reopen. So even if your school happens to be closed right now, I think some of this guidance and some of the questions that we're getting from districts when schools were open is important. You know, questions that we've been getting were things along the lines of, well, what do we do if we have a student who may have been exposed to the virus, right? So who hasn't tested positive, but maybe somebody in their household was exposed. It wasn't the student directly, but it was somebody else in the household, things of that nature. What do you do in situations where maybe the health department is saying to a student or a family that they need to be self-quarantining, and the family is saying, well, no, I still want my student to attend school. We had a couple of situations like that. So lots of different variables because, you know, typically we would leave to parents the decision of whether or not they send their child to school, and all school districts provide guidelines, but we haven't really been in a situation before, you know, where districts are seeking to really enforce those kind of guidelines and when students can be there and when they can't be there. So this is a different perspective, I guess, that we're looking at because this virus does spread so rapidly and it's so contagious.
So for part of the countries where there still are schools open, and certainly when schools go to reopen, we don't know exactly what that might look like. But in general, can you just touch on what districts can do to limit some of the exposure and how they can limit children from attendance when necessary during this time?
Sure. So our general guidance thus far has been that people need to really look to what their public health department is saying to them. You know, so whether that's your county or your city or the state that you're in, what are those folks telling you about which students should be in school, who should not be in school to limit the public health risk? There's no constitutional right or federal or state right for a student to attend school while they are exposing other students and teachers to the risk of infection during a pandemic like this. You know, so you are faced with some competing interests, and I would, again, prioritize the guidance that you're getting from health officials as opposed to, you know, well, maybe we're going to make parents upset or things to that effect. Some districts have policies that they might be able to rely on. You know, so I would say you check your district's board policies in terms of students attending school. But again, I would rely more on what your local health department is saying because I would rather see districts err on the side of caution and keep a student home because we can always provide a student with compensatory education or make up for that time somehow, as opposed to having a student come in and risk exposing, you know, a large group of people to this very contagious virus.
And also in terms of guidance, I'd just like to point out, follow obviously state guidance that states are developing, health departments are developing, the state departments of education, but the U.S. Department of Education has been recently releasing guidance on its website. Even just as of yesterday, they have put out guidance from the Office of Civil Rights that is all devoted to this virus. We also have available resources from the CDC. They just recently made available a decision tree that helps communities and districts figure out when they should be closing based on community spread. So make sure you're checking those resources too and all the available information that is out there.
I want to point out one quick resource is our website. We have a page on our website devoted to COVID-19, and you can find that at walterhave.com. And right on the first page, you'll see a link to COVID-19 updates from our law firm.
Also, as we kind of talk through the rest of this today, we're really going to focus on the impact of the school closures, since that's what we're faced with in Ohio, and many states are adding on to that order as well. Certainly use those resources if you're not yet closed, but we'll dive into some of the questions we're now getting with these closures and the issues that closures do create. Miriam, do you want to kind of start us off with some of those questions?
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, once a district or state decides to close its schools, there's just a whole new set of issues. And I'm sure, Christina, that you know, since Ohio closed its schools, that's pretty much the kinds of questions that we've been getting just about online learning and special education students. Is that kind of your experience, that most of your questions have been focused on that?
That's exactly right. We've been getting a lot of questions about how to potentially keep learning moving forward. We've been getting questions about how to make opportunities accessible to students, you know, recognizing that in some districts, everyone has access to computers and Wi-Fi. In other districts, that's not going to be nearly as feasible just based on the student population. We have, you know, some rural districts. We have some more urban districts where the same resources are not available to all students. So districts are really struggling right now to figure out how are we going to continue learning opportunities while still keeping people safe and keeping our school buildings closed. Lisa, did you want to talk a little bit about the meaning of the closure that's going on in Ohio? Because I know there's been some confusion about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so when the governor first referenced this closure, it was referenced as kind of an extended spring break, which I think some districts and many students took as this is just going to be closed free time. But it has since been clarified that really the intent is for districts to continue to educate students in creative ways, if at all possible, which is obviously going to look different district to district. But I did want to emphasize that we're not looking at just a pure shutdown of schools, that we're not educating our children anymore. We have a lot of administrators and teachers working very hard and diligently to come up with good creative ways to continue to educate our students, especially should these closures extend beyond the 3 weeks that we've started with, which I do expect if that happens, we will start to see some more specific orders, hopefully from the state regarding what that content needs to look like. Because right now we're seeing some division between, do we just give worksheets to send home? Do we do online learning? Are we teaching new instruction? Are we just reiterating already learned skills? There's a lot of different ends of that whole spectrum going on right now. So hopefully we'll start to see some more continuity should this closure extend further this school year.
So Lisa, if I could just break in with one more quick thing, maybe a piece of advice for Ohio school districts. I've had a lot of districts who at the very beginning, as you said, were kind of looking at this as an extended spring break, as the governor said, and maybe we're not going to provide a whole lot of learning during that time. I think as this situation evolves and it becomes more and more likely that schools are going to be closed for an extended period of time, a lot of districts that I'm talking to are utilizing these 3 weeks to really come up with good plans for online learning opportunities and how they're going to be rolling out instruction to students. So if your district is one that's in a situation where you're kind of waiting to see what's going to happen next, my best advice would be take advantage of the time that you have now to try to put things in place so that if we do have a more extended closure, you're ready to address that situation.
Yeah, and that's the exact impression I'm getting, is that really this start with the 3 weeks is somewhat intended for that purpose, for everybody to have a little bit of time to iron out what does this look like moving forward. But we know that certainly this pandemic is not going to be over in the next 3 weeks. So I certainly expect longer closures and really districts pulling together to figure out what we're going to do with that over the next couple weeks.
Christina, one group of students that is really raising a considerable number of questions is our special education population. So I'm sure that, you know, when a district is thinking about providing online services, one of the first questions that comes up is what to do about the students with special education needs. How have you been kind of advising or directing school districts?
I'm happy to talk about that, with the caveat that there's still a lot that we don't know given how the situation is unfolding and continuing to unfold. But I think the first thing that's important for districts to understand is that if you are providing continuing opportunities for learning to non-disabled students, then you have to provide continued opportunities for learning to disabled students that are commensurate with those same opportunities. So, for example, if you're providing new instruction to non-disabled students, then you would need to be providing new instruction and new content to students with disabilities. So that's kind of the first thing, just as an initial matter, from a pure we can't discriminate perspective, right? So we have to make sure that everyone has learning opportunities, even through this particular crisis, with the understanding that the learning opportunities for all students are going to look different if districts have had to suddenly shift from a brick-and-mortar platform to an online platform or sending worksheets home, that sort of thing. In Ohio, we have something called Blizzard bags. I realize not every state has that because most of you don't have Blizzards, or a lot of you don't have Blizzards. But in Ohio, we have Blizzard bags. And, you know, those are, you know, they're just packets of work, if you will, that teachers can send home so that when we have an extended closure due to a snowstorm, students can have learning opportunities. So districts are really looking at how do I do this? And again, the important thing is to make sure that you're doing the same thing, same kinds of opportunities for your disabled students as your non-disabled students. I am getting a lot of questions, and they're great questions to which we have no good answers about things like, well, what does specially designed instruction look like for my students with disabilities? Because sometimes it's harder for those students to access information that's coming from an online platform, particularly our students who have the most significant disabilities. So think students with cognitive disabilities, students with multiple disabilities, students who have autism, all of those students. The advice that I've been giving, frankly, is do the best you can. Intervention specialists need to be really thinking about how can I deliver instruction? Can I do it online? Can I do small groups of people? Can I use, you know, Google Classroom, Google Hangout? Can I do a Zoom meeting? How can I set things up? So maybe I'm even taking a small group of students. Like if I would be working with a group of two or three students in the classroom on a particular skill, can I set up an online opportunity at a scheduled time for those two or three students, you know, in order to access that and provide that type of specially designed instruction along with maybe sending materials home to parents? Something to go along with that is that the materials that intervention specialists are sending home to parents need to be aligned with the student's IEP goals. So these are going to be individualized in the same way that they would be if students were actually being served in the classroom. So again, for our students with disabilities, they might be getting two sets of work coming home. They might be getting things that are related specifically to their IEP goals, as well as more general education content for those students who are included in general education classrooms, you know, for all or much of their day.
Sure. That sounds like excellent advice, excellent things to keep in mind. And, you know, one thing that does come up, of course, is compensatory services.
We've been getting a lot of questions about that, and in all honesty, at this point, it's too soon to tell in a lot of ways. There is guidance that has been published by the U.S. Department of Education indicating that for students with disabilities, after this whole crisis is over, IEP teams would need to meet to determine if the student is entitled to compensatory services or not, you know, based on what was able to be provided during the break, and probably other factors as well, although no guidance has been given yet about what factors you might consider to determine whether compensatory services are necessary. To that end, what I'm advising districts to do as they are providing services to students with disabilities, make sure that your service providers are documenting what was done, right? So what services were provided? You know, did you get together in an online format? Did you send work home for students to complete? What were you able to do? How did you provide that instruction? So we'll have a basis going forward if we are in a situation where we're making compensatory education decisions. One of the areas in that vein that has been most problematic where I've been getting the most questions is with related services. So think about speech language services, occupational therapy, physical therapy. Those kinds of services are going to be some of the hardest to provide because so much of what those related service providers do is something that they're doing, you know, working perhaps like OT or PT hand over hand with a student, or you might need specialized equipment. So I know some of those providers are thinking about how can I adapt, how can I modify things, how can I send things home that parents can do, how can I put together some training modules for parents that they might be able to watch so they could see how to do a particular stretch or a particular exercise, things like that. So people are coming up with lots of creative ways to get this done. It's just a very challenging situation, you know, again, particularly for those students who have the most significant disabilities and those students who receive a lot of related service minutes.
Right. And as you've said, this is ever evolving, and we've received some guidance out there from, like, the U.S. Department of Education. Hopefully we'll get more detailed guidance as things develop from, for example, Ohio Department of Education in certain specific states that give some more parameters for all that. But really thinking outside of the box of how we can creatively provide these services is going to be super important right now.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that I have been advising districts to not do, and frankly, I don't know if this is what the Ohio Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education expects because we haven't received guidance yet, but I have not been advising districts to change IEPs around to reflect a different least restrictive environment or to reflect something different than what we would be doing if we were in a brick-and-mortar classroom. I recognize that we might not be providing all services or able to meet all goals on the student's IEP, but that doesn't mean that those goals or those services are not needed. It just means that in this current situation, we're not able to do all of those things. So I wouldn't want to see districts get together, teams get together, and make changes to all of these IEPs only to have to go and change them back when district operations return to normal. So, you know, again, we haven't gotten guidance on that, but that's the best advice that I have been giving people at the moment. And I don't know, Lisa, if you have some advice that you want to share with districts with respect to holding IEP meetings, because obviously we're practicing social distancing and not getting large groups of people together and all of that.
Yeah, and that has been a big question we've been getting repeatedly is, with our schools closed, does that mean we don't have to hold meetings and do timelines and those kind of things? And really the short answer is you are still responsible for these things. So, again, teams are going to have to think creatively, think remote meetings by phone, by Skype, by Zoom. Don't definitely jump to just we're going to automatically cancel all meetings. That's really not going to be advisable, at least with the guidance that has come out thus far. Whether or not that changes, obviously we'll try to keep you updated as we find out. But timelines, in essence, are still in effect. We do expect some flexibility and understanding from the Department of Education, but at the same time right now, school districts really need to attempt to comply as much as possible and be very diligent in their documentation of what your attempts are. Requirements like consent for evaluations are still necessary. We'll look at probably looking at some of the holes in this once schools come back together, but we really need to be considering the individual student and what different things mean for them. So figuring out whether or not a full evaluation for reevaluation, is that still necessary? Can we record review in some areas? Do we have enough data to do that? Or do we still need to bring a kid in to school just for testing or schedule a time for, say, a school psych or a related service provider to meet the child and finish some testing? Or are we done testing and we can hold an evaluation meeting because we have everything, we just need to finish the report and go over results? Can we hold that by phone? Can we review the IEP and do an annual IEP meeting because we do have the data to do that? And also certainly weighing the health risks in these situations as well. Obviously, for a child who has severe medical issues or even asthma, that's not going to be a child you're going to want to bring in even for one-on-one testing if possible. You're going to want to consider that whole situation. And certainly your prior written notices, we say this over and over again, but those really are going to be your best friend right now. So making sure that the decisions that you're making do get documented. There was just some OCR guidance we mentioned earlier that just came out from the Office of Civil Rights that does really align with some of what we've been talking about, that these children are still to be provided FAPE, but and that timelines should still be in place, but we do get some flexibility that you can read in that guidance to some degree as far as if things like observations are not going to be possible or face-to-face testing is not possible. Really, the big message is to do what you can, but again, like those prior written notices are going to be where you're going to want to be diligent about documenting what you've attempted, what the circumstances are, why certain things can't get done, and may ultimately end up delaying some, at least evaluation pieces for a little while. How about any other non-special education type of issues that you've been hearing, Miriam?
Well, one thing that we've been talking about a little bit is meals. So, you know, many students, depending on their socioeconomic situations, rely heavily on school lunches and breakfasts for their daily nutrition. Although it's not obligatory, although it's not mandatory, many school districts are offering meals during this time. The Department of Education, of course, encourages districts to try and make sure the needs of students from lower socioeconomic families are met. And we've heard about some really kind of creative solutions that districts have developed to try and provide this nutrition to children, but also in a non-public setting. So everybody's not getting together, you know, for lunch, obviously to keep keep families and children safe. Some school districts, for example, Lisa, have been having like lunches available in a pickup line. So you kind of drive through and you grab your lunch or your breakfast or both and you go. And, you know, another thing that I've heard that I thought was really nice is that some school districts are offering this regardless of a child's eligibility for free lunches. And I thought that was, you know, a good idea, a good way to go during this time of pandemic and crisis.
One of the positives we've been hearing, you know, through
sure,
all this,
yeah.
time of negative is how communities are trying to come together and are trying to provide for each other and be creative. And I think this is a great example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Another question, Lisa, that I'm sure you've heard about is testing. So, this is the springtime, and springtime is typically when many states do their annual state testing, which is pretty important. So what kind of questions and guidance have you been providing?
Yeah, this is definitely a hot issue. State testing for kids every year is kind of a passionate issue for a lot of people, and this certainly is coming up with the timing of at least the 3-week closures, and then obviously if that stems further throughout the spring. But the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, did issue recent fact sheet that talks about that they will consider some waivers for states regarding assessment requirements, whereas typically waivers are not given for any of these areas. So we do know that is potentially coming, looking at things that are just not going to be feasible because of closures and because of trying to prevent the spread of this virus. And this unusual step could make open waivers for states to waive whether or not mandatory testing percentages need to take place and things such as the testing windows. So we know there's going to be some flexibility in that. We don't quite know yet what each state is going to seek with those waivers. And obviously, if we see extended closures, if we will even end up seeing the testing completed this year or if we'll just see an extended test window. So some of that's still up in the air, but at least the guidance from the Department of Education has given at least some sense of relaxation in that there is going to be a little flexibility here, and they are going to be looking at what waivers they can provide to provide some relief to the states for these assessment components. The other thing I wanted to point out, too, absolutely. I think it brings at least a little relief in this time of kind of chaos for educators planning what they need to focus on. And certainly we always hear, are they teaching to the test? Hopefully we can relax some of that notion during the stressful time. But also before we wanted to go on, I did want to point out that there are some of these guidelines we've been talking about out there, again, on both the Federal Department of Education, many state departments. We're hoping that we'll continue to see more and more guidance coming out from at least our Ohio Department of Education as this develops. So keep looking back to all of these websites for the common questions and answers, so that you can be current with what's going on in your state. Because again, just the answers we have today are not necessarily going to be the answers that are in place come tomorrow. The other piece that we've been getting questions about, too, is confidentiality with all these circumstances. Miriam, do you want to kind of dive into some of those questions you've been hearing?
So we have been getting some confidentiality questions, both in terms of letting staff or families know when a student has been exposed or has fallen ill with the virus, and also questions about confidentiality in the online learning environment. Of course, audience knows that FERPA is a federal privacy law, and it prohibits districts from disclosing educational records and also personally identifiable information in those records without parental consent. There is, of course, a health and safety emergency exception, which does allow that kind of disclosure to appropriate parties. And I think that's the important thing to keep in mind. So if the district looks at the totality of the circumstances and determines that there's an articulable and significant threat, then the district may disclose information to any person whose knowledge is necessary to protect health and safety. And the key here is that you're only going to be disclosing that health information to people for whom this is truly necessary. And, that might include the Board of Health, for example, but it's not going to include everybody. It's not going to include, the families or the students. I mean, of course, there are rare situations, and, the Department of Education actually recently put out a guidance, FERPA guidance, specifically about FERPA questions that the DOE has been getting. And one example that they gave is in rare situations, you may need to release a child's name to other families. So, for example, if there was a student on a wrestling team and the student tested positive, and then the district may need to disclose that child's identity to other wrestling team participants. But this is very, very unusual, and I would urge everybody who's facing that situation to really consult with counsel about that. In general, disclosure is only to people for whom it's absolutely necessary to have that information for the emergency. And I know, that's what kind of what we've been advising districts. And I think those are more common FERPA questions that we've been getting now, Christina, are related to online learning and Google Classroom issues. So I don't know if you've been getting some of those questions as well.
Lots of questions about that. And I really appreciate the fact that districts want to be so cognizant of the privacy rights of their students, and they want to make sure that, you know, as we're switching to this different modality of learning that most districts have not been using, that they are, you know, again, very cognizant of students' confidentiality rights in that. What we've been advising districts who have called in with concerns about that is that really, if you have students who are participating like in a Google Hangout or a Google Classroom, or whether they're using a Zoom meeting or Skype or FaceTime or any of the technologies that are available to us, for those students, that's no different than them sitting in their classroom every day where they're going to be surrounded by other students. So there's no FERPA issues there per se. One of the questions that we've been getting, though, is, well, if we're in the classroom, then we know who's in there. We don't necessarily know, you know, if a student is learning at home, there's probably a parent somewhere in the house or sitting with them perhaps, you know, maybe even helping them at the computer if it's a younger student. So now that parent has access to see who else might be in that classroom. I don't believe that that creates a huge FERPA issue because most school districts allow parents to come in. They allow parent observations. Some classrooms have parent volunteers. However, districts should make sure that they tell their staff members, you know, be cognizant of the fact that when you're working online, if you have more than one student there, and you might have parents who are also listening, it's the same way that you would interact with your students to protect the confidentiality of information if you were teaching in a brick-and-mortar building. You know, so for example, you wouldn't say, oh, Lisa, you're going to get extended time because that's the accommodation on your IEP. You're not going to say that in front of the entire class. Likewise, you would not say that in front of everyone who's participating in the Google Classroom or on the Skype call, whatever it is. You know, it's probably something then that you would address privately with that student or that family later on if that was necessary. So I think as long as teachers continue to apply kind of the same common sense approach that they utilize in their classrooms, the online environment is not going to create any tremendous FERPA confidentiality concerns. So really quickly, something that else that came out in the OCR guidance, and I don't think that it was actually as much in the guidance document as it was in a webinar that OCR also put out, but something for districts to be aware of as we're talking about all of these online learning opportunities, they wanted districts to be very aware of the needs of your students who might have visual impairments or any other sort of a disability that might make online learning less accessible to them than it would for other students or even other students with disabilities. So just another wrinkle that I think districts need to consider and something that OCR is watching to make sure that the opportunities that are being set up are accessible to all students. And if you do have students with disabilities who are not going to be able to access that kind of learning, you know, based on their disability, letting school districts know that they're probably going to have to come up with other options for those particular students.
Yeah, that's a great point because OCR definitely has had a recent focus on that.
So in the webinar that I watched from OCR, they actually pointed out that they have, I believe they called it a task force dealing with this issue and went so far as to tell you how to file a complaint. So from their perspective, they're taking it very seriously. I know that we did get some recent guidance from the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. I wasn't sure if there was anything else in that guidance that you wanted to point out before we sign off for today.
Yes. So recently, the Office for Civil Rights issued some important guidance, and they emphasized that school districts need to be aware of the potential for national origin discrimination, for harassment, teasing, bullying of students from Asian or other backgrounds, you know, at this time based on this pandemic. And, you know, longtime listeners of our program know that bullying and harassment based on nationality is something that districts have to seriously and respond to promptly. We've had several episodes, about districts' obligations when they become aware of teasing and harassment based on protected categories. I mean, in general, school districts, you need to make sure that you're following your policies and procedures in responding to bullying complaints, both in terms of documenting the complaint, responding to it, remedying effects, and preventing any recurrences. Well, thank you so much, Christina, for joining us. Thank you so much. I really appreciate, you know, your time. I also just
Thanks
really want to urge everybody in the audience, if your school district has come up with some creative ideas or solutions that you particularly like, definitely email us and let us know. This brings us to the end of our episode. And in our next episode, we will talk about staff questions that come up related to COVID-19. And in the meantime, please stay safe, stay healthy, wash your hands. Have a good day.
The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The podcast is not legal advice, does not create an attorney-client relationship, and should not be relied upon in making legal decisions. Actions on legal matters should be taken only upon advice of legal counsel. Walter Haverfield does not guarantee the accuracy of information contained in this podcast.